broadcasting from the Gulag city of planet Earth. This is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. I'm Dean Becker. Steve Nolan is our engineer. After our interview, we will name the Cultural Baggage Coward or Hero of the Week. In a couple of minutes, we'll bring in Sanho Tree of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. But first up, I want to read a bit of a piece from Freedom Daily by Scott McPherson. Recently, the Office of National Drug Control Policy inadvertently admitted the effect of its own policies by broadcasting national advertisements telling people who use drugs that they are supporting terrorism. If helping to put money in the pockets of drug dealers is akin to aiding terrorist causes, then by continuing to drive up the price of drugs, the U.S. government is the biggest supporter of terrorism in the world. The war on drugs might possibly go down in history as the worst domestic policy blunder in American history. After more than 30 years of fighting, the cost in lives, infringements on our liberty, dollars, and the erosion of our social and moral fabric, and the impact on law enforcement and political institutions may never be fully known. Adding insult to injury, in all the years that the government has been battling to make people stop using drugs, it has been helping to enrich those who wish to wage terrorist war against innocent people everywhere. End quote. Our guest for this evening has seen the horrors of the drug war, has seen the destruction of the Central and South American countries that takes its effect on the campesinos and their families. He has seen the planes drop their Monsanto-made Roundup on the coca and food crops that forces these peasant farmers to move further into the jungle and thence further destroy the Amazon rainforest. Let's bring him in and kick the tires on this drug war. Let's grab the wheel of terror and take a spin down the decades-long road of prohibition. Let's welcome our guide on this adventure, Mr. Sanho Tree.
Yes, sir. If you would, tell us about your work for the Institute of Policy Studies and what your travels do, what you're learning on their behalf.
Well, sure. I work on the drug policy project at the Institute for Policy Studies. We're a multi-issue progressive think tank. We've been around for about 40 years now. And I work specifically on the intersection of race and poverty in the war on drugs, primarily internationally, but also domestically. And I also work on the so-called narco-terrorist phenomenon.
Yes, Sanho, we hope to do a show this coming September 9th, which you've graciously indicated you will be a part of on that very subject. And I want to ask you, the U.S. government has for decades now, they've been forcing their quote, if you will, Christian ideas of drug prohibition on the whole world. And the people here in the U.S. are starting to see the hypocrisy and the superstition and working against that policy. Do you see a similar stance developing in the countries in Central and South America?
Yes, I think most countries in this world are well ahead of us in terms of their thinking about how to deal with drugs, how to manage the problem rather than try to prohibit it, to pretend it doesn't exist, to make it disappear. There are countries that are bearing the brunt of our drug war, however. Countries like Colombia and Bolivia and Peru that produce a lot of the coca and the poppies where we get heroin from and have tried for years to stamp it out and have not been able to. And they are learning that lesson, that this simply can't be done, physically speaking and economically speaking. It's not possible. Yet at the same time, they're very much dependent on the United States' aid. So Washington really calls the shots, particularly in the Andean region, but also throughout much of this hemisphere. So in those countries, however, you will find very lively discussions about legalization being debated, for instance, in the Colombian Congress 2 years ago. They had a very lively debate on the question of legalization because they've been trying for so long, and all it's done is generated tremendous revenues for the guerrillas, the paramilitary death squads, the narco-traffickers. It's like giving these people an inexhaustible ATM machine almost. And that's where, you know, it really comes full circle in terms of the Bush administration's ad campaign on narco-terrorism. You know, we've all been watching these ads for the past 2 years now saying, kids, if you smoke a joint, you're supporting terrorists. In fact, drugs don't fund terrorism any more than soybean or wheat or corn funds terrorism. Drug prohibition funds terrorism. And the more we fight this drug war, the more valuable we make these commodities, and the more revenue people, including some terrorists, have access to.
Sano, I want to ask, you know, I hear the stories out of Colombia that the certain times villagers are just chopped up with machetes. How many of these campesinos and farmers die in Colombia and the other countries?
It's several thousand a year now in Colombia because of this four-decade-old civil war they've been having down there. And it's a vicious, vicious civil war where you have two left-wing guerrilla armies and a right-wing paramilitary alliance. They've been going at it for decades, and they've committed some of the worst human rights atrocities in this hemisphere. And our drug war is basically fueling that. A lot of these groups are no longer fighting for ideological reasons. It's no longer the Marxist insurgency versus the right-wing paramilitaries, although they still, you know, cling to that in terms of their press releases. They depend on that for their legitimacy. But in fact, these groups resemble gangs much more than ideological enemies. And they're fighting over turf. They're fighting over the revenues of the drug trade in that particular region. You know, a lot of the killing is actually revenge and cycles of vengeance and retaliation, and has much less to do with ideology.
Sano, you mentioned the paramilitary. I'll see if I get the name right. I think the gentleman's name was Castana, one of the right-wing paramilitaries, said, yes, we've been involved in torture and kidnapping and so forth, but we're going to quit in 2005. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, this guy, Carlos Castaño, perhaps the most notorious of the paramilitary leaders in Colombia. In fact, he's been very frank and open with the press over the years and has really, I think, shot himself in the foot. He's admitted that the paramilitaries get up to 70% of their financing from the drug trade, far more than the guerrillas even. And he's admitted to all kinds of massacres. He's admitted to many killings himself personally. And now he's saying that he wants to clean up his act. Well, it's a day late and a dollar short, especially when he's already admitted to all these atrocities in front of the media and published his own memoirs, as a matter of fact, where he acknowledges many of these things.
Yes, Sano, is there anything different about the Bush administration and those administrations that came before? And if so, what are those differences?
Well, in terms of the general paradigm, no, there hasn't been a tremendous difference except for this linking of an increasingly unpopular drug war to a more popular war on terrorism. So you see these narco-terror ads. But in terms of source country eradication, that's been an illusion both Democrats and Republicans have bought into over the years. We're starting to see more skepticism now in Congress, particularly from Democrats, but also from Republicans, about the efficacy of this kind of strategy. But the Bush people they believe in the same paradigms, but they're true believers. They really want to ratchet this thing up, and that's where it's going to get really destructive over the next couple of years down there.
A terrible situation. It reminds me, was it the minister's wife, Bowers, who was shot down a couple of years ago? Are they really going to start shooting planes out of the sky again?
Right. They suspended the aerial interdiction campaign after the shootdown of Veronica Bowers, the missionary and her daughter, 2 years ago. And now Rumsfeld was just down in Bogota, and he announced that they're going to resume that interdiction campaign. Where, you know, the fighter planes will identify suspected drug trafficking planes and force them down. If they don't land, they will shoot them down. And it's important to keep in mind that our assistance to Colombia is in the name of law enforcement, all right? It's not a war. It's not a military campaign. There are no rules of war being invoked here. This is law enforcement. We're helping Colombia enforce its own laws, policing. Now, what kind of policing can you imagine where the police can shoot unarmed suspects who have not been tried, not been charged, merely suspected? And if you fail to stop or you fail to land, and even if there's no landing strip nearby, they can shoot you down out of the sky. Now, you'll recall back in 1983 when the Soviets shot down Korean Airlines 007 over Kamchatka. That was an atrocity. You don't shoot unarmed civil aviation out of the skies if they don't pose an imminent threat to someone. If they're not a suicide kamikaze plane going into the World Trade Center, or if they're not armed, you don't blow them out of the sky. It may be that some of these planes may have malfunctioning radios. A lot of small planes down there don't have a lot of electronics down there. They fly by the seat of the pants. They're bush pilots. And that's how people get around, not just drug traffickers, but all sorts of people. So this is a really dangerous and reckless program.
Well, you mentioned Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and I'm reading a quote from him. The drug war is going to be won by our families, our churches, our schools, our doctors. Since as long as there is a demand, there will be a supply, and you can't solve this with a military solution. And I want to ask you, how can he be so right and yet so wrong?
Well, Rumsfeld's an enigma. He's been very much on the record over the years as being a skeptic of supply control strategies in terms of the drug war. And I believe that he personally does not believe in the drug war. In fact, I have it on very good authority that he's, you know, refused to sign certain deployment orders saying it's not a military function and we're not going to get involved in this. At the same time, he's part of the administration, and the administration has put a lot of emphasis on the drug war as being one of their main points of engagement with Latin America. And so he's got to be a team player. So on the one hand, in fact, the week before he went to Colombia, about 2 weeks ago, he told a town hall meeting at the Pentagon that he thought that, you know, this policy of eradication of opium poppies in Afghanistan was not going to succeed. And that, you know, it was very counterintuitive. The more you fought it, the more valuable it becomes. So he gets it. But at the same time, he's got to play ball with the rest of the administration.
I don't quite know how to put this, but are the American people hypnotized? Can they not see this? What power is it that these politicians wield? Or are they all just stuck in some sort of quicksand they can't get out of?
Well, take a look at it from the point of view of the legislators. All right, a lot of them are quite ignorant about this issue, and they see illegal behavior. They see people growing illicit crops. They see people using illegal drugs. And so their natural instinct is to say, well, you're doing something illegal. We want you to stop, and therefore we're going to escalate law enforcement. And it's kind of a reflex action. A lot of them, you know better, but many of them still fall into this. Now, what happens when you increase law enforcement in the face of a prohibition economy? Here's where it gets tricky, right? Because when you escalate in law enforcement, the people you tend to capture tend to be the people who are dumb enough to get caught. No offense to anyone who's been busted out there, but, you know, the slang on the street is that the dealer who uses loses. You get careless, you get sloppy, you get apprehended. And so the people we tend to miss when we escalate law enforcement tend to be the people who are the most efficient, the most adaptable, the most innovative. They stay one step ahead of the law. So for decades, we've been selectively breeding super traffickers, right? We've had a policy, an unintended policy of artificial selection for the most efficient drug traffickers out there. And so we can't hope to win a war on drugs when our policies see to it that only the most efficient operations survive. And not only do they survive, but they're richly rewarded, because we've done two things to help them. Number one, we've taken out the competition for them. We've rounded up the little fish. And number two, we've tried to constrict the supply while the demand remains constant, thereby driving up prices and profits for these people. And so what starts out as a knee-jerk, you know, good intention, you know, drug dealers, traffickers are bad, we got to stop traffickers. So politicians fall into this trap, and it gets worse and worse. So fighting drug prohibition, to me, is very much like struggling in quicksand. The more you struggle, the faster you sink.
We're going to take just a little break.
This is Mark Greer, Executive Director of Drug Sense. You're listening to Cultural Baggage on 90.1 KPFT in Houston. To end the drug war, visit MAPINC.org. That's MAPINC.org. Get active, stay aware, stay informed, and let's bring an end to this nonsense.
I'm for legalizing all drugs, just like alcohol. We've tried over and over and over to get a guest or a caller to disagree with what is said here on Cultural Baggage. In more than a year, we have yet to receive any flack for what we say. So tonight, I'm not taking any calls. If you disagree with our position that declares the immediate need of ending this eternal drug war, send me an email to my new address, drugwarnews@kpft.org. We want to bring you on this show. If you are genuine in your beliefs, whether you're a cop or a judge or simply a concerned accountant or a soccer mom, this is your chance. I want to put you in the chair next to me and allow you to express your concerns on the air for all to hear. Again, my new email, drugwarnews@kpft.org. Well, let's get back with Sanho.
All right, you're back on Cultural Baggage. We're speaking with Sanho Tree of the Institute for Policy Studies here on KPFT Houston Pacific. And I want to ask you, Sanho, aren't we, the United States, really responsible for not looking at this policy, for not making the nuances, the changes that would turn this around? Do we need to arrest 10 million more American citizens, or would it be better to regulate the distribution to adults?
Right. I think the responsibility lies with us here in the United States. But it's very easy for politicians to say, oh, it's those people are the problem. It's those people who are growing and supplying this stuff. They're attacking us with these drugs. You know, some politicians say we're being assaulted by the guerrillas and the paramilitaries in Colombia by these drugs. If it's an attack, it's the strangest form of attack I've ever seen, because we are willing to pay premiums of 10,000, 20,000% for the privilege of being attacked. We're begging to be attacked with these drugs. That's how strong our demand is. And so we need to look at, you know, this from the point of view of demand. And that's what's driving this economy. And I think regulation is the only way to take the profits out of this industry to the point where you can keep organized crime and these criminal elements out of this equation. Trying to attack drugs at the source is absolutely futile when you look at just the realities of Latin America, for instance. In Colombia, two-thirds of the population, two-thirds of all the citizens of Colombia live below the poverty line, which is roughly about $2 a day. Right? Imagine paying for your clothing, your transportation, health care, housing, education, everything on $2 a day, fertilizers, you name it, right? And so these people have very little to lose when they grow these crops. And what our policies of eradication do is make these crops more valuable. Right? Our policies of aerial fumigation, of eradication, are basically acting as an unintended form of price support. Right? It keeps these commodity prices high when they shouldn't be at all. And so in a region where you have such extreme poverty, you're not going to make these substances disappear by making them more valuable, which is what our policies do.
Sanho, I want to ask you, there's a new traveling DEA museum. It's going to start up in Dallas on September 9th. And they're trying to tie drug users to terrorists again as if it were science. And I'm wondering your comments on that.
Yeah, I think, you know, this bogus narco-terror campaign, first of all, I think the DEA probably spent more money on creating that traveling museum exhibit than the narco-terrorists actually got from, you know, from drug trafficking. But anyway, the idea that, you know, they can link drug users to terrorism is frightening. First of all, there is no such thing as narco-terrorism. Right, that might sound like a controversial statement, but there are certainly terrorists in Colombia who practice acts of terrorism. There are certainly drug traffickers, but there's no such thing as a narco-terrorist. We have farmers in Appalachia who are very poor, about to lose the farm, commodity prices are low, so they grow a little marijuana. We don't call them narco-farmers or narco-hillbillies. We have students who might deal a little marijuana in order to pay their tuitions. We don't call them narco-students. But when it comes to the issue of foreign policy, it's very convenient to have this construct, this political construct of narco-terrorist. Just like a generation ago, politicians were terrified to vote against any legislation that had the word anti-communist in it. I mean, you're not for communism, are you? Now they've combined this very potent boogeyman together. So you've got this narco-terrorist phenomenon. So if you dare vote against more drug war money to fight so-called narco-terrorists, you run the risk of looking soft on drugs, soft on terrorism, soft on communism, soft on crime, all in one stroke. So it's a particularly dangerous ploy that these people are playing around with.
I understand that thanks to our efforts in Afghanistan, that they are now once again the world's leading producer of heroin. Have you had a chance to study that subject?
Yeah. It's not so much our policy. Well, it's policies that have been in place for forever with regard to Afghanistan. Afghanistan is one of the dirt poorest countries in the world. And it's also been undergoing a terrible drought. And so these peasant farmers who grow opium poppies, they do so because it's easier to grow. It doesn't require as much water. If they were to grow wheat, for instance, it would take about 9 waterings per season to get a wheat crop out, whereas poppy crops can be watered twice. And you would generate, you know, many, many, many times more revenue from growing poppy than from growing wheat. With that level of poverty in Afghanistan, it's a no-brainer what these people are going to do. Until such time as we can provide a functioning infrastructure and economy for Afghanistan, those people are going to continue to do what it takes to survive.
It's my opinion that this situation that we're enduring, this drug war, is exactly what the drug lords want. That whether it be the smugglers or the growers or the bankers who launder the money, this violence, this disruption of our society is exactly what they want so they can maintain this policy. And for years, we've had cops playing the parts, you know, of doctors and scientists. And I'm wondering just how long can this endure? When will the truth shake loose from this?
Well, first, yeah, I agree with you. It's the drug lords and the traffickers who want this system in place as much as the drug warriors want this in place. They both want it for their own personal interests. They both get revenue from the drug war. It's a bit like, you know, imagine there were a secret formula to turn water into gasoline. You know, Saudi Arabia would want to, you know, crush that formula and destroy it. So would Dick Cheney, for that matter. These things are valuable because they're scarce, either naturally or artificially scarce. And when are the American people going to realize that's not going to work? Well, I think the polls are fairly consistent. You know, about 3/4 of the American people don't believe the drug war can ever succeed. We're not winning it. We're not going to win it. But here's the disconnect. People don't know what to replace it with. It's a bit like standing at the edge of a cliff. And it's pitch black. You don't know, you know, what's beneath you. You could take a step off, and it could be a 100-foot plunge, or it could be an escalator going up. We don't know. They don't know. And so the better we can articulate an alternative to the drug war, the more people, I think, will be willing to embrace something different. And I think there are lots of different experiments that have gone on in European countries, Australia, and other parts of the world, where people have learned to manage these problems rather than declaring a war on them.
Thank you, Sano. I'm looking at a story here from the L.A. Times. It's telling me the Colombian Air Force chief quits. And this is following a bombing of a village by U.S. civilian personnel. Is this correct?
Well, there was an incident called the Santo Domingo Massacre where a surveillance flight by a private military contractor working for Occidental Petroleum identified a village. They said, we think there are guerrillas operating here. And so they called in an Air Force strike from the Colombian Air Force. And it turns out that they massacred a bunch of civilians in this bombing. And so, you know, that's another case of U.S. private military contractors getting involved in Colombia and causing, you know, all kinds of collateral damage, just as the shoot down of the missionary plane was done by a private military contractor. That's one of the great underreported stories about this conflict, is that we are outsourcing and privatizing the drug war in Latin America. It's no longer U.S. service personnel directly in the line of fire. We pay private military contractors, mercenaries, if you want to call them that, to go into the line of fire and do these dirty jobs for us. So that if they get killed, if they do something bad, it doesn't show up in the media the same way it would if a U.S. service personnel did it directly. And when they get killed, you know, we don't have flag-draped coffins flying into Dover Air Force Base with honor guards. They're simply listed as private contractors who you know, died in the line of work.
Sanho, I want you to, if you will, tell my listeners how they can get in touch with you or where they can get additional information on this subject.
Well, they can reach me through my website at the Institute for Policy Studies. It's www.ips-dc.org. Or email me directly at stree@igc.org.
Sano, I understand that we've wasted well over $1 trillion U.S. taxpayer dollars on this drug war. If it continues for another 10 years, I understand that we'll have arrested 7.5 million of our own citizens in this drug war. What can the average citizen out there do? How can they help bring about the end of this drug prohibition?
I think it's going to take a lot of people communicating directly with their legislators. People don't realize how much power they actually have at the grassroots level. Our elected representatives don't commission polls every time there's a controversial issue to be decided in their district. They have to figure out what the district is feeling through extrapolation. That is to say, for every call that they get, they think, well, maybe there are 500 people out there who are concerned about this issue. If you write a letter to them, maybe, you know, 1,000 people. If you visit them, maybe 2,000 people are concerned about this issue in their district. They try to guesstimate, you know, what the level of concern is in that district. And so when you communicate with your legislators, you're not just doing so on your own behalf, but you're doing so on behalf of the imaginary, you know, hundreds or thousands of people in that congressional district. So it's well worth your time to do that, and there are a lot of strategies for doing that, and that's it's a whole other program area we can get into, but lots of techniques for reaching out.
I'm hoping that we can do just that on this show we have scheduled for September 9th. Hope to bring you and Eugene Oscapella, a barrister out of Canada. I'm talking to a couple of doctors who are going to tell us the truth about what drugs do and don't do and what the cut in the heroin is doing to our addicts out there in the population. Sanho, thank you so much for joining us here on Cultural Baggage, and we look forward to your visit on September 9th.
Thanks, Dean. I look forward to it.
All right, thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
For their work as a grand deceptor, hypocrite, lying weasel, bigot, corporate whore, baby raper, superstitious shill, or ultra sinner, Cultural Baggage is proud to present the Coward of the Week. Well, it was bound to happen. He stands up every day of the week and proudly proclaims that marijuana is addictive. He says that high-potency pot is a danger, and he says that we need to keep putting our children in prison lest marijuana harm them. So therefore, this week we choose the current reigning drug czar, John Walters, as Coward of the Week.
Basically, the idea is to change political consciousness in this country so that our children, hopefully our children and certainly our grandchildren, look back on the drug wars of the last few decades and of today with the same sort of distaste and contempt and even horror that we look back today on the Jim Crow laws and the slavery in our own nation's history.
Ethan Nadelman, Executive Director, Drug Policy Alliance, drugpolicy.org.
I want to thank you for joining us this week on Culture of Baggage. Our guest for next week, Matt Elrod, the webmaster of the Media Awareness Project, mapinc.org, and we'll have Philip Lucas, the head of the Vancouver Island Compassion Society, a pot pharmacy. That's next Tuesday at 6:30.
Now I'm up in Vancouver at the Cannabis Cafe, smoking good old Sensimilia. At the beginning of the day.
So in closing, I ask that you always remember, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. So please, be careful.
For my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. KPFT, Houston.